I'd like to now introduce our guest speaker for the month of June. I'm getting better. And this will be Greg, and tonight he'll be speaking on steps 2, 3, 4, and 5. And he's from Freehold.
Hi, everybody. I'm an alcoholic. My name is Greg. It's nice to be here again. Once again, it is. Last week, I didn't tell you, my home group is from Throckmorton Street Group in Freehold, New Jersey. My sobriety date is 1/29/90, and there's nothing I did to deserve that date. You know, it's just that circumstances and the pain got great enough for me to finally try something different. And where I left off last week is where I'm going to finally try something different. Even though at the time, my motives were really not based on getting sober. You know, it was just to make the pain, the misery go away, get a roof over my head, get an apartment, make my life back the way it was. You know, I always had these fantasies, these dreams of the way a household should be, even though I never lived in a household that I had an example of that. But I had these own fantasies about myself. And so now, it's 30 days later from my last detox. And each time I left the detox, I went right back to where I was, right back under the bridge. You want to talk about insanity. You know, my mind told me there's nothing wrong here. What am I doing here? I shouldn't be here. Let me go back under the bridge. Let me go get whacked. You know, because that's all I knew how to do. And it made it all right for me to be wherever I was. But for some instance, the little voices kept saying, this ain't cool. You know, I kept trying to put a finger on a problem. I couldn't figure anything out. But the only thing I could do, and the only thing my mind kept saying was, I'll take care of you. Just do this. So I'm packing myself up. I had nothing to pack. I didn't even own underwear. I had nothing except what I had on me, and that was a little, one of those little sissy belts they call. I don't know what was in it. Maybe a toothbrush. Maybe a pair of scissors I robbed, because every once in a while I would change my appearance by cutting my own hair without a mirror. You'd try that sometime. You really got a picture. You know, anybody ever seen Down and Out in L.A. with Nick Nolte and Richard Dreyfuss? Beverly Hills, something with it. He ate with the dog and stuff, and I was living like that. I smelt that bad as he looked, you know, and here I am. I think I got control, you know. I think I got control. So I'm going back to the detox, and again, they welcomed me with open arms. And the first two detoxes, I made fun of the speakers that came in. I counted 500 times. One woman said, and you know, that's where my mind was. I didn't want to hear what these people were talking about. My mind was the little stories you were telling me. A functioning alcoholic, I'm not making fun of you, but those are the stories that were coming in, and I said, these people don't know nothing. These haven't suffered like I was. You know, I was really unique, and I was full of me, and I'm making fun of these people, and I'm laughing at them left and right, and I'm being disruptive. Everybody's telling everybody to turn off their cell phones, and here I am talking over everybody, you know. Story of my life. Guy gave me, one of the social workers at this time, this is the third time I'm in a detox. Guy gives me his big book. I said, what's this? Just like I threw the step book months before, gave me a big book. And this time I said, went back to my room, I opened up the back of the book, and it was a story of a woman. I said, again, she didn't suck. She didn't do half the things I did, you know. And I, about a half hour later, I gave the book back to the guy. The guy says, you finished? I said, yeah, I read it. No big deal. I didn't have a clue. And when I said last week the process started, just like the little Puerto Rican at the bus stop told me I should go to AA and NA, go to the detoxes. People are always trying to help me. But this time again, the pain, the circumstances of how I was living, and I was going to try something different. I mean, I can't say at this time, I had an open mind, you know, and all this. I just knew what I was doing wasn't good. It wasn't good. So I finally made it to the 28-day rehab, you know, and in there what I learned. You know how they give you these charts and electrodes and what happens when you're under the influence and stuff, and I came to the realization that my bumpers weren't working. You know? You ever get a pinball machine and the flippers don't work? Like the electrodes, the guy's explaining it. The electrodes are going and the bumpers aren't shooting the things off. I says, yeah, I got bad bumpers. But But that's what I was trying to do all my life, and I succeeded. And I'm thinking, how are you going to fix him? How are you going to fix me? What are you going to do for me? You know? And then they had little sessions and stuff, little powwows. And I'm there one day, and they asked, they had a group session, and what do you think about this person? You know, just like an AA, I gave her my opinion, you know. Some things happened in there, and I can't say this. I started hearing speakers a little bit more. I didn't fully identify with them. I was still comparing them, but I heard them. And some people did touch me. Some people did touch me. You know, it was around Christmas time again. Now, I've been on the streets for, I don't know how, a couple of Christmases, a couple of New Year's. New Year's is my birthday, a couple of Thanksgivings. And it's getting Christmas holiday season time again. And some guy came up to me, I don't know who he was, a volunteer, and he says, what do you want for Christmas? I said, I would like some underwear. And some socks. I kept it simple. And come Christmas time, I got underwear and I got socks. And I also got a meditation book for men's only. And I just mentioned that because it was one of the first books I did finish reading. You know, because we had a calendar. I knew which day it was. And I could do some simple like that. I also had took art class in rehab. And I made a card. Again, I told you it was Christmas time. And I made a couple of cards and I ripped them up and I threw them away to send to my mother. My mother hasn't heard from me for 17 months. And I'm aware of that date because she told me it was 17 months. I've been on the street. She was looking at morgues, you know, hospitals, police departments and stuff. And when they say, and I was guilty of this, I'm not hurting anybody. Leave me alone. You know, I'm only hurting myself. You hear that? That is such a lie. That's such a lie. So bottom line was I finally had the guts to send the card. I didn't even sign it. I didn't put a return address on it. I mailed it. And by the postmark on it, of where it was from, my mother identified my, I don't even know what the hell she identified, but she found me. You know? And when she walked in, we had a visit thing, and when she walked in, my mother was a very, she was a full-figured woman, even though she was short. And she walked in, she was nothing but a pencil. So you can't tell me we're not hurting anybody. You can't tell me we don't affect everybody we come in contact with, and the ones we love the most, love us the most, we hurt the most. Things happen. I had no place to go when I got out of there. It was a 28-day rehab. I went to some interviews for long-term treatment centers. I went to a couple in Patterson, and I went to one in Marlboro. And Patterson was a waiting list. Marlboro was an interview. I went there with my sister. And I would have got in if I had $350. You know, money talks. You know, bring money, you get in anywhere. But I didn't have the money, so I went back to rehab, and they took me for another week. They were gracious enough to take me for another week. Now, mind you, I'm a homeless bum, and I'm an indigent, and I don't know who's paying for this, and I wasn't asking questions. So about a week and a half later, no, they made arrangements for me to stay at my sister. This is in the process. People are putting out for me. I was going to stay at my sister's boyfriend's apartment, little basement apartment. I made all sorts of promises that I was very sincere in keeping. I told them I wouldn't drink anymore, I wouldn't do this, I wouldn't do that. I would look for a job. Hopefully I would get a job and I would continue to go to meetings. And I was sincere as I am here today because I really meant it. I really meant it. And each time I got out of the detox, it was only a matter of me making a phone call and getting out and going back to do what I was doing. And this time, my sister picked me up, introduced me to a boyfriend, showed me the place. My mother gave me money, had the refrigerator stocked for food, gave me some more money for the week. And then the thought came across me. I've been sober like almost 42 days now. Oh, made a phone call. Made some excuse to my sister, went out and back and did the same thing again. When the thought came, I told you last week, obsessive compulsive. I got a thought, I acted on it. Because that's all I knew. That's all I knew. There was no difference. There was nothing. I didn't hear nothing about anything in these rehabs. It was just bad bumpers, you know. No steps, no God, and anything else. Psychodrama. I went on like this for another week and a half. I never looked for a job. My mother kept giving me food money, and I wasn't buying food anymore. You know, I went right back to where I was. And I get a phone call. Actually, they called my mother's house. It was Discovery House, saying they had a bed for me. my mother called me. She says, "You really want to go there?" And I said, silently, I said, "No." But I said, "Jim, I do." Now, for once, the right words came out. Made that long drive. I remember I was trying to be good. It was Super Bowl Sunday. I was trying to be good all day. I'm going to rehab. I can't get whacked. You know, don't drink. You're going to rehab. You know, 10 o'clock that night. I waited long enough. Thought came again. Made a phone call. I was up all night. I'm trying to do this. I'm trying to do that. I'm trying to sleep. I'm drinking beer, just sleep, and I'm doing the other thing to keep me awake. And I'm not gonna have enough time. Blah blah blah. Next thing I know, the horn is beeping. It's my mother and father going to drive me to the place. So they ask you, how do we arrive at AA, you know? We were driven here, right? And they would say that when I got into AA after the rehab, which I was in for 13 months, how'd you get here? And I says, my sister took me, or my mother and father took me, you know. That's a sick joke. They didn't want them right out like a lead balloon. So when I get in this rehab, my mother's crying in the waiting room. She's crying because she sees the change, the bars, and all this other stuff. And she says, "Is this where you really want to be?" And I said, "Yes." Because driving up that long drive to Marlboro Psychiatric Hospital, fitting place for me to be. It's like a country setting. It's like a campus. It's a college campus. It's gorgeous. I said to myself, "I'm going to be safe here." Because at this point, I knew my destructive behavior. I knew where. That's the only thing that came to me. I knew I would do it again. I told the people there, I don't think I told them, but this was my own little pledge to myself. Says, "Just leave me alone. I'll abide by your rules. Don't make me share. Just leave me alone." Because I had some of that in the rehab, and you know, a little self-knowledge you get from these places. I said, "Just don't make me talk." And every time I go to morning meeting, and they'd be picking on somebody, and the guy would be crying, and they'd be trying to get emotions and feelings out, and they're talking about issues and stuff. And I'd be like, "Leave that guy alone. Leave that guy alone. Look what you're doing to him. Look what you're doing." So me and another guy on the same dorm, we made a pact. You had to share. This is part of your thing. You got to share. You got to participate. And he says, "I'll raise my hand and I'll say, yeah, I have no issues," and blah, blah, blah. And I says, "Yeah, and I'll give you feedback. And I don't have no issues either," you know. So that was the first time I shared it, you know. Just so I don't have no issues. Don't leave me alone. You don't have to bother me. But I wound up staying there 13 months, and they don't leave you alone. There's no place to hide. There's no place to hide. I got left back from moving up in phase group. I got left back in a rehab. Not because of anything I did, because of lack of participation. My motto was on the streets, "What you don't know about me can't hurt me." You know? And I ain't telling you nothing. I'm not telling you how I lived on the streets and garbage cans. And I'm not telling you. Don't make me do this. Don't make me do this. They left me back and they told me, "You got to start sharing. Otherwise, we're going to discharge you." Oh, man. A lot of sleepless nights. A lot of headaches. A lot of headaches. I got through that, and I didn't do too well at it. I did the best I could. I signed my name, and I got up in front of people, and whatever I had prepared to say, because they screened you, and then you went to the formal thing, and it never came out. It never came out. I couldn't do it. And so it was 13 months. You know, I'm looking at myself, and the first time they brought out that step book, now they're getting into serious stuff. You know, they brought out a step book. It says, "We admitted we were powerless over alcohol, that our lives were unmanageable. We had to surrender. We had to admit complete defeat." And I could feel the veins swollen. And what are you talking about? I must have been loud like I have been all my life. And, "What are you, powerless? No, what are you talking about?" And then the counselor, after we finished reading the step, he said to me, "What do you think about this, Greg? I think it's a crock of shit." Exactly. I don't talk like that anymore, but that's what I said then. I said they were crazy. I don't know what the hell I know what they were talking about. Powerlessness. What are you talking about? I'm not powerless over anything. Defeat, surrender. See, those things meant weakness. And as sick as I was and as messed up as I was, I said, "I'll give you my life. I'm unmanageable, as you can see. You know, I'm not doing too good in that area. I'm just down on my luck right now. But don't talk about all that other stuff." And then they kept pushing, you know, came to believe that a power greater than ourselves. And I said, "These people are out of your mind." I said, "I went to Catholic school. I've been there all my life. God is the reason why I was under that bridge. God is the reason why I am the way I am today. Don't make me try to do any of this stuff." So again, 13 months of this, them pecking at me, me pecking back, and I don't know when it happened, but I just had a guy walking me around, talking about God. I can't see him, you know, all the same excuses you hear. I can't see him, there's no proof, or look at me, blah, blah, blah. And then he says, well, you're still alive. There must be a reason why you're still alive. And then I started thinking, oh, Jesus, now there's something else I got to do. And when I came into Alcoholics Anonymous, when I got out of the house, I finally got out of the house, I got a room. I couldn't, you know, I had so many more problems than I can ever solve. I finally got another check. I was expecting this big check that was really going to save my life. It was going to be more money than I'd ever seen in my life, but it turned out to be it wasn't. And it was a gift from God that it wasn't. You know, I got a job. I went through the whole process. Me and another guy got a room together because I couldn't get gas and electric in my name. I couldn't get a phone in my name. I didn't have a driver's license, and I was a poor credit risk. So we got an apartment together. We got a nice place, and now I come into AA. I'm in the real world by myself. I don't have no counselors. I don't have no... I'm in the real world, so to speak. And they're talking, turn it over. You know, give it to God. And if you want what we have... And I'm saying, what do they got? Nobody's telling me. What do you got? You know, you want what we have. And finally, if you want what we have, then you already take certain steps. You know, but then you can't keep it unless you give it away. And I'm thinking, Jesus, if I want what they have, I got to get this. I got to do this. I can't keep it anyway, so why am I going to bother? And then I get an inspiration. And he's sitting in the corner here. And I say, if he can do it, God knows I can do it. I noticed I didn't mention. You see, we're reading. When I was still in there, I'm reading the step book. I'm reading the third step. I'm reading the fifth step and the seventh step. And I'm saying to myself, these people are crazy. But at this point, getting out of there, there was a change of heart. I was convinced that I could not control or run my own life. I was convinced of that. I make no decision properly. I made a commitment to myself the day I walked out of that house that I'm going to try this. I'm going to come to the silly meetings because I was going to meetings while in certain phases. I'm going to give this a shot. They convinced me that you made a mess of your life, Greg. You know, they didn't convince me on anything else. And they're talking about turning it over. And one guy we all know, I can't think of his name right now, this guy was dying of cancer. And I remember, I'm only 2 weeks out of the house. I'm working part-time 3 nights a week, and I'm up and down. I don't know where I'm going. I get to the 12:30 meeting, and this guy's dying of cancer, and he's talking about giving it to God, turning it over to God. You know, and I had to raise my hand. And I said, what are you talking about? You know, I was angry. I was more frightened than anything else. And I said, I've been here for 2 weeks, and I don't know nothing. Man. How do you give it to God? What's this all about? And please. And then I started bad-mouthing Freehold. You know, these people don't understand me. I got that uniqueness came right back. You know, yeah, but you don't understand. I'm different. Freehold's a one-horse town. The streets close up at 9 o'clock. I'm from Bergen County. Whoop-de-doo. You know what I mean? You know. And all everybody said, yeah. They all raised their hand. One lady says, well, I wasn't going to share today. Well, Freehold's a lovely town, and I lived there all my life. And everybody else just kept telling me, just keep coming back. Just keep coming back, Greg. You'll get it. I was forced, I mean literally forced, to ask my sponsor in front of a counselor because I was still on their outpatient thing and stuff. And I asked this guy. He used to give me rides home. I set my sights. I knew this was going to be my sponsor. So one night he took me home. He was with his son, and we're coming from a meeting. And I said, hey, you sponsor people? He says, yeah, I do. He says, oh, okay. I got out of the car. I found out later, Sunset, I think he was asking you to be a sponsor. Yeah, but my sponsor said he didn't ask me. So I had to take this guy to meet the counselors at the institution and stuff, follow my requirements to graduate this program, their program. And they were talking, and it came up that he wasn't officially my sponsor. He said, Greg, you didn't ask him? I said, no. And he made me ask him. And I could feel my face getting red, and I felt like a little kid. And I, would you be my sponsor? You know? And I felt that humiliation many times, asking, girl, would you go out with me? You know? And that's exactly what I felt like, a little kid. One thing I got to remember is somebody else used to tell me there's six little words we got to say. I don't know. I need help. So eventually I was getting to that point. You know, we talked about a lot of things, and my sponsor asked me to read the book, and I gave him that the quote that I gave. I don't know if I said it last week. I said, I never read a book in my life. I don't see why this book is going to help me, so I don't think I'm going to start now. You know, so my sponsor, in his infinite wisdom, gave me a set of tapes. He didn't give me a set. He gave me one tape, and it happened to be We Agnostics, the first thing I've heard, and it started making sense to me. You know, I had to ask myself, the question was, what do these things mean to me? What do they mean to me? You know, tomorrow, Friday the 13th, it told me in my book here, I had to lay aside all superstitions, all traditions, all old ideas, and that's what we're working on. So I was filled with all old ideas and emotions and fixed things, you know. It's just the way it is, it's the way it is. And I've learned today, even today, we hear people say it all the time, why can't we do it this way? Because this is the way we always done it. You know, and they kept telling me, Greg, get an open mind, don't take yourself so serious, you know. Lighten up a little, because I had blinders on, I was set to this, I made a commitment, and I was going to do this hell of high water, but I didn't know what I was doing. You know, I was a very serious glum lot, and I also thought that was a one-word thing until I looked in the book, and it's two words, glum lot. And they told me, lighten up, Greg. As you can see, I've lightened up a little bit. If you're not laughing at yourself, Greg, you're missing the best joke in town. Yeah? I didn't like that. Yeah, I didn't like that. I didn't like that. Learn to laugh at yourself, Greg, because everybody else is. You know, people would ask me to go out after the meeting, go to lunch and stuff, and I can't do that. I can't do that. I made excuses. I got to go back to. I got to go sleep. I go back. I don't have enough money. I can't do that. So this one day after I bashed Freehold, I had some money. I didn't have to go to work then. I had no excuses. So I says, okay. And so the fellowship was starting around me, you know, and my sponsor was working on me. My sponsor introduced me to his sponsor, who wanted to take me on a big book study. He even paid my initiation fee. But my mind says, I can't do that. I can't go. How am I going to act? I don't have enough clothes. How am I going to stay in a hotel room? How am I going to mix with these people? And I didn't go. I even offered to pay him back his $25. He says, you don't owe me anything. My mind is a terrible thing. And they kept pointing that out to me. Your mind's your own worst enemy. You know? You are powerless. You need a power. At this time, I'm starting to understand what they're talking about. I even fought the word allergy. I said, I don't have no allergy. You know, I fought everything. You know, my sponsor once told me that I was belligerent. I thought it was a compliment because I knew it was in the big book. I looked up the word, and the word says warlike. Always fighting something. Whether I'm not fighting it, I'm giving into the fear of it. You know, I just kept giving into myself, and they didn't let up on me. Again, I got to meet my sponsor. He took me on retreats, Matt Talbot retreats, and I found out that this is a spiritual program, that I needed some help. And the one thing I got out of my first retreat was it was a bunch of New Yorkers. It was a split up group, and they were all from Queens, and these guys were still sick. And I'm saying to myself, I remember, but I ain't that bad now. So I did get some hope, and I did, not that I got some more hope, but I seen it, there was something working in me. You know, I was able to maintain a certain, and there was some peace coming in, and I don't know where it was coming from, but it was. It was like, I made that commitment, and we were supposed to talk about the third step here and stuff, and I had to open up my mind, ask myself, what do these things mean to me? What do they mean to me? What is God all about? I believed in God, but God didn't work. Remember, I'm a Catholic school kid. I'm a bum on the street. I'm homeless. Look at all the problems I got. God didn't work. So like everybody else, I said, yeah, I'll make the home group. I'll make the group my power and stuff. Yeah, I'll do that, you know. Yeah. And then I go home and pray. And how obnoxious was that, you know? I didn't believe in God. I didn't even trust him, but I go home and pray to him. I say the serenity prayer. I couldn't remember, but I say the serenity prayer. I get to the meetings, I get to work. I had to ask for rides. I had to ask for help. You know, I worked at 11 o'clock at night. Sometimes people would drop me off at 9:30 to go to work at 11. But people were always there to help me. You know, I never missed a day of work. I never missed a meeting because of lack of help and stuff. And one day I said to the guy who was driving me, I said, you know, I'm really getting tired. I really feel bad about having to ask everybody for rides all the time. And the guy said to me, he says, don't ever deny anybody the privilege of helping you. Don't ever do that to them. You know, don't make excuses up in your head that they're busy. Maybe they're not even home. I didn't even call them yet. Maybe they're not even home. You know how we do that. They're not home. Why bother? And they just kept pounding on me. And I went to a lot of STEP meetings. And they read out of all the book, our essay book, that goes hand in hand with this book. And I'm beginning for the first time in my life asking questions. I said, what does this mean? What's spirituality mean to you? And I asked another guy, and asked another guy, and I always get different answers. But the one that gave me the answers is just being good to yourself and being good to other people. I could do that one. That one I accepted. I accepted that one. And even when I was in the institution, we were in a certain phase, and one of the guys got his car, and we were able to go to meetings. We went to a lot of beginners meetings, and it always seemed to be on a third step. I says, oh, here we go again, the decision to God, and blah, blah. You know, but somebody made it pretty clear to me at that meeting, and he said, look, we're just turning it over to the care of God. You had care of your life for as long as you were alive, and look what you did to yourself. You know, and then my sponsor and the tapes helped, and other people talking to me, and they said, you know, turn my will, my life. What will God have of me? You hear that all the time. What is God's will for me? You know, well, I found out if you keep reading this book, it tells you, you know, God's will for me is to be happy, joyous, and free. You know, all the problems I had, God didn't cause it. You know, God didn't do it. You know, that's God's will for you. My will and my life are nothing but my thoughts and my actions. See, I can understand that better than will. Will is really out there, and it's spooky. And then again, you were talking about psychic change. You were talking about spiritual experiences, spiritual awakenings. You were talking about being rocketed into the fourth dimension. And then later on in the book, he says, you have now entered the world of the spirit. And it was a little, I thought I was doomed, and it was a little heavy for me to take. It was just too much, all that stuff and talking. Thank God I had some guys that could keep it simple and do it in their own language. Because I'll never talk like Bill Wilson. I'll never be that elaborate as you can. Sometimes I try and I foul up even worse. And they took me to the appendix. And everybody told me from the day in I got here, all I had to do was change. I had to change. And I would think, change into what? First it was Brooks Robinson, then it was Earl Weaver. And then when I got my sponsor, I said, I could change it to my sponsor. And he said, and just like his sponsor told him, he says, you can't be me. You just be yourself. Just be yourself. Be the best Greg you can be. And I could try that. My life went on. You know, I went on that whole first year, and you talk about early sobriety, and a commitment to go to do the fourth step. I told you, I went to a lot of step meetings. And back then, my sponsor, he suggested, read this book. And he gave me a form, just like Joe and Charlie used to hand out. We all hand out the column form. I had to go get a Hazleton. This is where I'm at. I had to go get a Hazleton guide. I had to go get an NA guide that I had to pay for 75 cents. They had the nerve to charge me. I had to get other information, and I had to get all this stuff. And I got overwhelmed again. The pen wouldn't move. Nothing would work. You know, I'm going to meetings. I'm asking questions. You know, I said, I really want to do this. When am I going to be ready? When will I know I'll be ready? And their answer was, you'll know. It kept getting me, you'll know. It ain't good enough. It ain't good enough. So I started, even in Discovery House, we went to a meeting, me and a friend of mine. And at one of the meetings, he was handed a card. It had the third step prayer on it. And Chris says, yeah, look at this. I don't want this. You have it. And I'm saying to myself, if you don't want it, what makes you think I want it? But I started reading that prayer early on, even in an institution. And it had the vows, doubt. You know, and I had the same impression that a lot of other people get. Thou, you know, old Catholic school stuff. But I started reading the words and relieve me of the bondage of self and stuff like that. And And in that institution was a saying they had on the wall, and I was supposed to memorize this, and I never did. But the only thing that sticks out to me was, free me from the chains that bind my life to nothingness. Third step prayer, relieve me of the bondage of self. You know, and so I started doing the third step prayer. I started looking at it, and I started asking God for help. And there's another thing I don't usually talk about, but everybody told me I got to pray. I got to get down on my knees, and I got to pray. Again, old ideas, Catholic school. You know, this whole thing you're telling me, they want me to pray, you want me to read, you want me to write. Those are old ideas. I hated to do that in school. And now you tell me I got to get down on my knees. And now I'm alone in my apartment. Lou's gone. I got the door closed. I still cannot get down on my knees. I don't know if it was shame, guilt, fear, or what was it. People would give me tips, put your slippers under your bed. When you get out of bed, you kneel down. I would get out of bed. I'd be petrified. I'd reach under, pull the slippers out, turn over. I don't know what it was. For a while in AA, I was waiting to be good. I was waiting to get good so I could do these steps. I was waiting to get good. God was gonna tell me. I'll know when I know. They kept telling me, you'll know when you know. And somebody said, Greg, these steps are our friends. They ain't going to hurt you. They're not going to hurt you. They're not going to hurt you. We don't wait to get better to do these things. We do these things to get better. So, again, doing the third step prayer. Doing the third step prayer. I made no formal decision. I made no formal third step prayer with my sponsor. My sponsor, when he got me, he got better. You know what I'm saying? Because he had to work. I finally put him to work. At the time, he was just staying one step ahead of me. Now, this is just the way it was for me and him. And his sponsor was working with him, and it was going good. It was going good. So I'm praying. I'm waiting to get ready. And I went to bed one night. My pen wouldn't write. I went to bed one night, and I didn't even think about it. And I was off. 4 o'clock in the morning, I woke up. I got up. I grabbed the pen. I got whatever piece of paper I had. I didn't even have a pad prepared. I used to write on the back of empty cassettes and stuff. You know, but the process started. I started writing, and I finished what was in my mind up at that time. You know, the years back survey, that wasn't for me right then. Not that it wasn't for me, it's just that I wrote down what I could write down. I called my sponsor, like, before he went to work, and I says, I did it. I got it done. I says, I'm going to take a little bit more time and see if anything else comes to me. But it's like when you're in the bathroom and you're constipated and nothing else came. So I took a whole week. I took a whole week of sitting on this thing. Because I remember, now I got to tell him. I got to tell this guy. I'm pretty good from where I am, you know. And one thing I did learn by going to the meetings here in a different area. I grew up in Burn County. I'm in Freehold County. Writing these things, old names, new names, that I'm still the same guy. These people, I just met these people, and I'm looking back and forth, and I'm seeing the same, they're doing the same things to me. And I realized in the third column, which was really tough for me, the unrealistic expectations. You know, I told you, I'm easily frustrated, I'm easily disappointed, you know, especially from the ones I love. And now I'm trusting these people, and you these people are on my list. What he's doing to me. So I realized that it was me. I'm starting to see a pattern here, you know. I'm starting to see a big pattern here. And I wasn't too easy with it, you know. I'm starting to realize that they say selfishness, self-centeredness, I'm starting to understand this, is the root of all my troubles. I'm an extremist. I'm the maker of all my troubles, and I identify with the next line. It says, but we usually don't think so. And I was the one, but I don't usually think so. So now I'm starting to see this stuff, and I didn't like it. I had nobody else to blame. And I'm also, everybody told me you're a very angry guy, and in the house, in the institution, La Miserable, the play, was very popular. That was my nickname. You know, I was a miserable... Yeah. Not many people told me it to my face, but I knew it was. So I'm seeing what a sick, miserable, unhappy person I am. expecting everybody else to take care of me, make me better. And I also found out it's not the people that are doing the things to me. You know, it's what they're doing to me that hurts. You know, so there goes the hatred for my mother. There goes the hatred for my father. It's starting to go away. I mean, how can I hate them? They raised me. They put up with me. You know, and I didn't even get any further with this. I'm starting to see these things. I don't like it. I don't like it. You know. We're in a meeting one day, and I want to try to stay on the third step here because I know I'm supposed to speak about my experience and other people's experience, who I took through, and that's pretty difficult because that's their experiences. But I remember me and my sponsor were at a meeting one time, and we heard the word, you voice it out loud, and you know, you get down on your knees with your sponsor. And we both looked at each other, and we shrugged our shoulders. You know? How come we didn't? I said, how come we didn't do that? And he's like, ah. You know? So we went and we did it. We went and we did it. And it was a profound effect. It was nice. It was nice. It was difficult. I told you it was difficult for me to pray by myself. So to break this ice, you know, it made it a little bit easier. And the process, again, it's a process. It's a process. I had to have my struggles. And there's a little story I like to tell him because it's a good story. The guy's walking down the street and he sees a cocoon with a butterfly trying to get out. And the guy thinks he's going to do the butterfly help. He's going to cut it open and he's going to free the butterfly. Butterfly gets out, flaps his wings a little bit, and dies. So he goes to his botanist friend and says, he told him what he did, and he says, you shouldn't have done that. You shouldn't open it up. The butterfly needs the struggle of getting out of the cocoon to strengthen himself so he can fly. So for me to stand up here and tell him about other people's struggles with the third step and say, I really can't do that. I can tell you the hard times some people had that wouldn't kneel in front of me, that would squat. I allowed that once, you know, and then the second time you got to kneel. my very first sponsor, my very first sponsee, was more religious than I was. I would go to mass and retreat with him, and he knew all the words, and he would pray without a drop of a dime, get down on his knees. Him and his uncle would get down. So this guy knew more than I did, and he had no problem with it. Now he had no problem with it. He was convinced. He knew God. Matter of fact, he helped me more than I think I helped him. When it came to that part, you know. And I had another guy who didn't believe in God at all. I gave him the Sermon on the Mount. Figured he was intelligent, he was a college student, he could read this. And then he started quoting to me from the book and stuff. And next thing I know, he was reading Zen, you know. So some people just keep looking. There's nothing wrong with Zen. And he even went to the Buddhist, he went to the Greek God, he's reading Aristotle. Some of us just keep looking. Some of us just keep looking. And a guy I heard on a speaker tape, and he says, if I found God on this corner, it took me long enough to find him here. Why go over looking on the next corner? You know, why look anywhere else? And they told me, stop fooling yourself. God's not up there. He's not gray hair. Don't make him human. Don't make him this. Don't make him that. He's a little voice inside you that you always fought all your life. He's just there. You know, deep down inside, we were fooling ourselves because he's always been there. I just didn't listen to him. You know? Didn't listen to him. When I did the fifth step and stuff, and I tell you, I had a little sheet of here. I had the cassette paper. I had this. I had that. And did I get a feeling of one with my Creator? Did I feel one with the universe? Did I now belong to a fellowship? Did I feel... Yes and no. I could see it now, the word yes comes up. But then, no. I felt like an open wound. I felt like I was open and people could take pokes at me. But the one thing I felt I did something I'd never done before. And I did feel part of. Because I did what other people have done. And now I feel like I belong in Alcoholics Anonymous. I am now a member. Not just because the desire to stop drinking is, it makes you a membership, that just gets you in the door. You know, it just gets you in the door. There are some rules, some restrictions, requirements is the word. And the requirements was I had to smash all my old ideas. I had to cast aside all those things. I had to make a decision. Again, it was a commitment to myself. I was convinced that I could not run my own life. I had to stop playing God. My idea didn't work. The God idea, it came around. And where did I get my benefits from? It wasn't the second. It wasn't the third step. It really wasn't even the fourth step. It was sitting down with the fifth step I really was looking at these things, listening to myself say these, and then looking down and says, you wrote this. You wrote this. The benefits I reaped out of doing these things came afterwards. I now had a way to keep myself resentment free. Although I don't always do it, I got a way of doing it. Now, it was that simple to me. It was that simple. The best thing I got out of the fifth step was I got to see myself. I got to see the chart. I got to tell myself, tell on myself to another human being, and I wasn't judged. I wasn't judged. As a matter of fact, when I got back home at night, matter of fact, I went to work that night, and I'm pacing in the aisles, and I'm saying, why did I do that? Why did I do that? Why did I tell him that? And then the other voice would come back, and he did because he wanted to, because it was necessary. You know, you hear, and it makes so much sense, we're as sick as our own secrets. You know, I got to learn to tell myself I won't be judged. People have done it. People have done worse than me. People have done less than me. You know, we're just different. We're just different. But we have that one thing in common, we're alcoholic. You know, and we have that one solution in common, and that's what I was looking for, the solution. Once I stopped fighting, it just came. It just came. And then going on later on, I kept some things hidden. I didn't know. They were so deep, deep down inside of me. And I talked a little bit about last week, all the trouble I got into. I didn't say that. It never came to my head. Because I so neatly put it aside. It was taken care of. It was fine. And I came up later and I told the guy about it. And later on, when I did fifth steps with other people, see, this is how we keep our memory green. I learned more doing fifth steps with other people. I give them a little encouragement. They may share something about themselves and other things that I forgot to do came out. I was able to help them, share with them. And my first fifth step, you couldn't touch me for like 2 days. You talk about pink clouds, cloud nine, you couldn't touch me. You know, you could say things, bounce right off of me. You know, I was in euphoria. I was more elated than I did when I did my own fifth. It was just a feeling. And it says here what happens. I get the power to help somebody else recover. That's all I get here. You know, everybody's sitting around waiting. What am I going to get? I remember I heard a guy say, I can't wait till I get my spiritual awakening. And even me, as sick as I was, I says, good luck, cause, you know, good luck. And I didn't know. You know? Something happened to me during the process of doing these things. What you didn't know about me can't hurt me. What you know about me ain't gonna hurt me now. You can't touch me. I already told you it's water under the bridge. Back off, Jack. You ain't gonna shame me no more. You can't do nothing to me that I haven't done to myself. Don't bring up my past. You want to rectify? You want to learn by my past? Here it is. But don't come to me with that criticalness and that judgment, because that's all I had my whole life, and I'm tired of it. And you hear that so much in meetings and stuff, and I'm still guilty of this stuff. He ain't going to make it. He ain't going to make it. I ain't going to make it. Look what they're doing. My sponsor and a couple other sponsors came up to me early on when I was there, and they were telling us individually, you know, if you hang out with the people with the same amount of recovery, you're going to get the same recovery. And I'm saying, where else, who else am I going to hang out with? You know, I don't know why I even went back that way, but the struggle. We all need struggle. We all need fellowship. The fellowship is divinely wonderful. I don't even know how Bill puts it. Extremely wonderful. You know, but the fellowship alone, and I realized that will not keep me sober. I had to do what everybody else did. I had to do the work. Again, just casting aside, and it's all we do here. Sometimes, still today, I want to say this, because I was just at a retreat beginning of the month, and the retreat master broke down the serenity prayer. And it was apropos here, how we selfish self-centeredness is our troubles. We step on the toes of others and they retaliate, sometimes without provocation, you know, but we always set the ball in motion, you know, and he's talking about the Wizard of Oz. with Dorothy, the Tin Man, and Toto coming down the Yellow Brick Road. And they're happy. And out of the tree, from behind the tree, comes the Cowardly Lion. And he goes, growl. And they jump back, you know. And he gets an impression on it. He goes, growl. And again, they jump back. And Toto, being the dog and the protector of Dorothy, is biting, you know, barking at himself. So he starts chasing the dog. And so Dorothy now, in her fear of Toto, whacks him over the head. And what's he say? Why'd you do that? Why'd you have to hurt me? All my life I spent trying to be tough, doing things to other people, selfishly, self-centeredly, without thinking, without just doing. And when you said you learned how to love, I found out in this process I didn't know how to love. You know, I didn't know how to take care of a cat, never mind a relationship or anything else like that. And just trying to be tough guy all my life. And I was so scared and so feared. And when I realized, again, I don't have to be afraid of anything anymore. You know, I have my fears today, but my fears don't have me. You understand that? It says all men of faith have courage. We wouldn't need courage if we didn't have any fear. See, the difference between me today is I'm not easily frustrated. I get disappointed. But I understand it. I understand it. I try to get a little more effectiveness and a little more understanding today. And that's what the whole thing is blended into. Now, I really, unless anybody else can think of anything else I should say, I think I'm done. I really think I'm done. Again, other people's experiences. What do I do? How do I take them through? I take them through the way the book says. Again, I've learned differently. And each time I work with somebody different, and people will verify for this, I know better, I can do better. That's the only thing I could say with that. I know better, I do better. The 12 steps says, get to know the person. Get to know all about them. So that takes some time. It takes some time. It's not easy for me to make snap judgments, like I said before. It takes some time. You know, like I said, John knew more about religion than I did. Other people had no clue. It's just a process. Two people working together. Two people working together. And our ultimate aim is to find the solution, the power that can take us to where we've got to go. I'm done. Thanks.